You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold, and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in overblown sports narratives. I'm Chad McMatlin, editor of 538. With me, Kate Fagan. You look pumped today, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Pumping your fist during the Hot Takedown intro.
I just love the Skip Bayless part.
It's true. When we took it out, you were in mourning.
I'm always dancing to it.
And with Kate and I, Neil Payne, sports writer, 538. Hey, Neil.
Hey, Chad. How's it going?
It's going great, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah, your Eagles, Neil.
Yeah, they didn't do so hot.
Yeah.
Not ready to talk about it on Hot Takedown quite yet.
So on today's show, week one of the NFL has come and gone, and we are still talking about the Patriots. We will make sense of the Steelers' headset claims and break down other curious coaching decisions from the first week. Then, to help Carl Bialik grieve the end of another tennis season, we'll ask him to make sense of Serena's loss and Novak's greatness at the U.S. Open. And finally, we'll talk about Yoenis Cespedes's difficult thing to say. Cespedes's MVP candidacy and whether leagues should matter when doling out awards and how we keep talking about the Mets on this podcast. And, of course, Allison McCann will be by with significant digits. But first, before all that, we have an important update to check in on. Walt Hickey is in the house. Hello, Walt.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Long time, short time, Hot Takedown listeners will remember that last week we issued a challenge. We threw down the gauntlet for all Madden video game players to put you, Walt Hickey, into the game and win the Super Bowl with you, Walt Hickey, as quarterback. Walt, has anyone won the Super Bowl?
Nope. But we've actually seen some progress that we did not expect to see. So last week I made the bold call of saying it's either going to be the entire season, no one will ever be able to do it, or somebody's going to win in the course of a couple hours. And it turns out I think that we actually have something of a middle ground here. I think that in the past week we've gotten responses from about a dozen or so players who have put me in the game and strenuously tried to do as well as they could. And apparently somebody has made the playoffs, which is far better than I thought that anybody would be able to do in the first week.
What was the record with which they made the playoffs?
They didn't include that information, but the best record that we have received so far is someone went 8-8 with the Detroit Lions. I was not the best player on the team, but I was behind center for all of it, so there's something there, right?
And some people wrote in asking for more details about you and how your avatar should be made in the game. Do you want to fill those details in?
Yeah. So in addition to the stats that we've posted last week
on 538.
On 538.com, check it out. There are some other stats that you can also plug in. Mostly these are aesthetic stats, but people were asking for them, so we felt like we'd go into them. I am 6'2". At the time of evaluation, 210 pounds. I went to the College of William & Mary. And the other thing that we are not going to do is we are not allowing experience points over the course of the season because there is absolutely no indication that I will ever improve.
Okay. And so how long should people continue to try to win the Super Bowl with you as their quarterback?
Good question. So we realize that this is a fun challenge. It's a way to kind of see how exactly Madden is able to kind of replicate a terrible, terrible individual behind center. But we were thinking of capping it just for September, you know, and then maybe after that try something else. But we want to see if in this month we were actually able to get somebody to win the Super Bowl with me behind center. So we were thinking end of the month.
And should we worry about injuries, about you being injured, either in real life or the game, because of this happening? Should injuries be on or off?
In real life, I am deliriously clumsy. However, in the game, we've decided to allow people to set my injury rating to 99, because if you are going to
jump... The only thing you're the best in the league
at. The only thing I'm the best in the league at is desperately not being allowed to not be behind center. Yeah.
Okay.
Is it the case that you would get hurt otherwise? Like, is your injury rating normally so low when they assigned you the ratings?
Vastly immediately, yeah. My injury rating was nothing too special, if I recall correctly. I'm not going to break immediately, but I don't know. I do not think I would really fare well out there. But for the purposes of this little experiment, we are going to say I am basically bulletproof.
I'm assuming they don't. They would love to put the backup QB in, right?
They would love to. Yeah.
So that's right. Not an option.
Wild have to play all games. So, okay, listeners, you have 2-ish more weeks to win the Super Bowl with Wald Hickey as your quarterback. Write in to podcast at 538.com. Those of you who are just now listening, all the details are available at 538.com.
And Wald, what would you do if hypothetically your team was up 3 near the goal line, like around a minute 15, minute 30 left? You think you'd go for the score? What's your IQ on that?
I would run it in that in the,
You're saying you don't trust yourself as a Giants fan even to go punch
I'm in. Still dealing with that loss emotionally on a whole bunch of different levels. It's
you and Neil can commiserate in the NFC East corner. Yeah. Okay, listeners, write in, podcast at 538.com. Wald Hickey, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks again for having me.
All right, let's move on to football. And before we talk about the Patriots, we're going to start a new feature here on Hot Takedown. We would call it Concussion Watch, except PBS has already created Concussion Watch, where they track the players who have been concussed throughout the season. But we wanted to keep track of how many players were concussed in the NFL this year, partly because concussions are going to be just as much of a storyline this year as they have in the past, and perhaps even more so because there's a movie coming out with Will Smith in December in which the movie dramatizes the saga of one doctor who's trying to show evidence of concussions' effect on the human brain and the NFL squelching it.
Yeah, and partly because so often we just have like a number that we talk about, and we're not actually cognizant of the athlete who is behind that number.
The number of concussions this week was 6, and the players were Corey Graham of the Bills, Luke Kuechly of the Panthers, Josh McCown of the Browns, Deion Sims of the Dolphins, Lorenzo Modlin of the Jets, and Trumaine Johnson of the Rams. And again, we're going to do this every week just because it's a data point that's in the conversation, and we want to keep our eye on it and what makes up that data point. Okay, you guys ready to talk Patriots?
Yep. Let's talk Patriots.
It feels like we've been talking about Patriots in the sports yak sphere for like 6 months. It's the amount of oxygen the Patriots take up is unreal to me. Maybe it's because I'm a Jets fan. I don't know.
Well, they are Super Bowl champions, and I think that also feeds into it. But
so the Patriots play the Steelers in the opening game last week. The Patriots won. After the game, Mike Tomlin had a bit of a hot take about why the Steelers lost.
Your radio went out, your communications.
That's always the case.
Here?
Yes.
Well, you're saying that every time you play here, you have radio.
I said what I said.
Like what exactly happened? You just didn't have any communication?
We were listening to the Patriots radio broadcast for the majority of the first half on our headsets.
All right, so what Mike Tomlin is alleging is that when opposing teams go to Foxborough, to Gillette, they are getting a raw deal, and that the Patriots are somehow taking over their headset communications in an effort to get an advantage, the way that we've seen them do in other ways, as reported by Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham at ESPN, that this is one more element of the Patriots' cheating regime. Neil, let's assume that it's true that the Patriots mess with people when they're at Gillette. Is there any evidence that they're taking advantage of that, that they're better because the people visiting them are somehow handicapped?
Well, they have a fantastic home record, especially since Bill Belichick took over as coach in 2000, and that's one of the few unambiguous statistics that we can kind of throw around in this whole thing. So kind of to get a sense of whether that was abnormally good, we used what we have here at 538 called ELO ratings, which just try to figure out how good a team is at the moment of the game that they play, to set up sort of an expectation for how many games they would win, and then compared the Patriots' actual home wins to the expectation from ELO, and we found that there was...
So can I slow you down there for one second?
Sure.
So basically what we're saying is Patriots were supposed to be a certain kind of good coming into the game, mm-hmm. so we'd expect them to win X percentage of the time, and we're seeing whether or not they won even more than we would expect given their talent level.
Right, yeah, we're almost like handicapping it and saying, look, we know the Patriots, they're a good football team, so of course they're going to win a certain number of games at home, but did they win more? And if you look at that, since Belichick became coach, they did in fact win...
They're cheaters.
About 12 more games than they should have based on ELO, and that there was...
Over how many years? 12 and a half over how many years?
Since 2000.
Okay,
so
over
including
14, 15
the
years.
Beginning
yeah.
of this year, yeah. And so there was only a 1.4% chance that would happen, that kind of discrepancy would happen. If
so
they truly
one out of
were,
100 times, they'd be that much better than we'd expect them to be.
Yeah. Without artificial factors.
Right.
which could include something about you know, their coaching or anything like that. But we can kind of that's a very naive sort of first pass, because we can also look at the Patriots. Right, yeah, that's the one that kind of implicates them. But if we look at how they play on the road, they're also really good. They outplay expectations on the road, and there's only an 8.7% chance that they would have that kind of gap between their actual and expected records in their road games. So if you kind of go through all the machinations of this and compare every team's home record to its road record, turns out that the Patriots are the best home team compared to expectations, but they're just kind of a narrow leader since 2000. Seattle is almost at their level, only with a 1.7% chance of kind of exceeding expectations as much as they have at home. And the Ravens are also right there too. And then if you look at road teams exceeding expectations, the Eagles are even better relative to expectations on the road than the Patriots are at home. There was only a 0.8% chance that the Eagles would exceed expectations as much as they did since the year 2000. So if you kind of put those together and look at a team relative to not only its expectations at home, but also how it outperforms expectations on the road, the Patriots aren't really that special. They outperform expectations in both areas, whereas a team like Minnesota plays much better than expected at home and much worse than expected on the road. Seattle, the same thing. Arizona, Cardinals. Whereas the Patriots are, you know, really excellent at both at home and on the road. So that seems to indicate that it kind of is more about the Patriots as a team, their great home record, than some kind of chicanery that they're committing at home specifically. But again, this is all so deep into the numbers, and you know, some of this stuff is really difficult to measure, I think.
One of the things that Don Van Adens and Seth Wickersham wrote in their story that Chad, you mentioned earlier, was that other teams had accused the Patriots of going into their locker room and swiping, you know, the play calls for the first 20 plays of the game. And that sounds like it would give them a huge advantage, but even in the numbers breakdown that some, I don't know if it was Deadspin or another website, did to see if you could prove over time during Belichick's regime whether the Patriots had some sort of advantage in the first 20 plays of home games. And the advantage was marginal, not the kind of you would just expect as a fan. If, like, oh, you know the first 20 plays, therefore it's going to give you this wide berth of an advantage against your opponent. Like, that didn't even exist either, which to me all goes back to what seems like, if you believe, you know, the ESPN story, this pursuit of very, very marginal increases. And we're just so used to in sports with the Lance Armstrong cheating scandal, and in baseball with steroids, like, kinds of cheating that just, if you were going to go down that path, sets you so far apart as to be so much better and a champion, if you look at Lance Armstrong, or if you look at what it does for hitters in baseball and perhaps pitchers. And what the Patriots are doing is just, it's just so marginal. And it's exploiting these tiny loopholes that get them advantages that you just, statistically, you can't even, like, gather up the sum to say it equals X.
Well, and what's interesting to me then is when there's a cultural element to this, which is that if the Patriots say they're going to stop at nothing to win, and they act that way, let's say, by stealing play sheet calls, Spygate, Deflategate, depending on how you feel about Deflategate, that maybe trickles down in an unempirical, unquantifiable way into the ethos of the organization. And so if I know that I'm the 53rd man on that roster, that I need to do anything I can to win because I know my coaches are doing anything they can to win.
Right, yeah. It may go the other way, where the ethos of the team actually kind of, the logical outgrowth of that is to kind of look for all of these marginal things because they've already done all of the things. Like, if you hear about the stories of the Patriots, you know, once Belichick came in there, the way that he overhauled their scouting system and the way that he prepared, and his former players will tell you, in different ways than they had seen in other places and other teams. So, you know, maybe that attention to detail within the rules is what leads you to kind of look for the things at the edges of the rules and try to skirt them in that way.
Although you have to kind of keep the larger viewpoint of how this all is about football. And by that, I mean, it's a game where no one player can really change the outcome of the game. And whereas in other sports, it's specifically a solos board, if you yourself increase your own ability by cheating, you directly affect the outcome. In football, we're talking about it being marginal, and obviously it is marginal, but there's not much in football that isn't a marginal increase.
And maybe the flip side of this is that in an era in which steroids are going to be banned through rigorous drug testing or through the sort of shaming that happens in the public media because of it, you have to turn to this marginal increase as opposed to the increase. It might double your lung capacity or double your muscle fast switch reactions or something the way that steroids would. That now we're in an era where cheating means marginal improvement as opposed to revolutionary improvement about one's self.
The low-hanging fruit have been either already taken or outlawed.
Or banned, yeah.
And even in football, it's like if you have a certain player who was on steroids before some of this rigorous testing, like how much of a percentage was he really impacting your ability to win? You know? Especially when you know that other teams likely, percentage-wise, have a few players who are taking steroids as well. Like in the game of football, those are kind of negating each other, whatever marginal impact the player is going to have.
But what's interesting is Tomlin, to get back to our take, you know, that because the Patriots have created this culture around them, we're seeing different routes into the conspiracy theory or into the thought that they are doing a marginal sneaky advantage. And Tomlin really articulated that, where I think, you know, this doesn't seem to be I thought Deflategate would be the end of the Patriots, of everyone obsessing with the Patriots. It's just the beginning. It's opened up so much, right, especially how we've seen Deflategate related to Spygate.
And he said it was always the case that every time they went to Foxborough, something weird happened, and you know, you start looking for those. Perhaps it's a coincidence, perhaps it's not. You start noticing it when a team has a reputation for bending the rules or outright breaking them.
Okay, if you'll forgive us for not talking about the Patriots and allow us to talk about the Giants, remain in our East Coast bias for a second. Let's talk about that third down play call that Tom Coughlin did. Eli Manning at the goal mouth, up 3, $1.40 or so to go. And they went for it. They went for a pass. Pass incomplete. Cowboys march down the field, take over for the Giants. Neil, did the Giants really blow it by going for a pass on third down like it seems they did?
In a certain sense, yeah, they certainly contributed to Dallas having a chance to win. And our colleague Brian Burke of ESPN Stats and Info, he's the guru of all things win probability. He did some calculations of what would have happened or what the odds would have been had the Giants done something different. And he looked at a situation in which they allowed the clock to run by either taking the sack or running instead of throwing an incomplete pass. And the Cowboys would have been left with about a 5% chance of winning and driving down the field with maybe 50 or 49 seconds left. And in reality, they had an 11% chance of winning. So when you look at it that way, it's almost whether it was Eli Manning or Tom Coughlin who made the call, they doubled Dallas's chances of winning. But even that doubled chance of winning still left them with almost a 90% chance of winning the ball game, and that other 90% was responsible by the defense to stop the Cowboys as they drove down the field. So it depends on how you look at it. Those 5 percentage points, 6 percentage points that they threw away, those were free. They you know, just gave them away for free. But at the same time, it still took a monumental defensive breakdown or great drive, depending on how you look at it, to make up the other 90%.
Well, it sounds like also Eli, at least from what I read today, said that he told Jennings in the huddle on first down to not score because he thought the Cowboys needed to burn that last time out. So I'm wondering if our data guru over at ESPN processed what the win probability would have been if Jennings had scored a TD there. And then certainly you give the Cowboys the ball back with much more time on the clock. It would have been like 140, 150. But then they have to get two scores. So that, to me, obviously would have been best case. I would rather, you know, if I'm a Giants fan, I'd rather be up 10 and have the Cowboys have to score and then kick an onside.
Right, and a lot of times you get into this trap of being too cute almost and like overthinking it too much, where we've all seen the plays where the runner intentionally goes down and doesn't score and it gets lauded as being, you know, such a smart move, such an unselfish move or whatever. But that doesn't always, you know, especially in the moment, you don't have a win probability calculator in front of you. You know, it seems like taking the points is not always the worst decision to do.
So we have to move on to tennis in 1 second, but I just want to note we spent the last however many minutes obsessing over a 5 percentage point increase or decrease in win probability. And it relates to what we were saying about the Patriots, which is that these marginal win chases of wins is what we're now into. And what's interesting is we really care about them when they happen on the field with players and whether or not the right coaching decisions are made. But they feel so much more abstract when it's about the Patriots stealing play sheets or something like that. But they perhaps are about the same amount of percentage point increase to a win. Coaches who we did not get to, Pete Carroll in particular, you're lucky. We ran out of time. Future weeks.
I'm sure he's a loyal listener.
Future weeks, Pete. We're coming after you. Onside kicks in the overtime.
You're way
in
on the West Coast, though.
I don't know. That's true. We don't talk about anything out there. All right. Let's leave it there for football and move on to the U.S. Open. All right. We've dragged Carl Bialik out of his sensory deprivation chamber that he goes into after every major Grand Slam tennis season is over. Carl, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be awake.
So, Carl, people in the Hot Takedown feed have been listening to your Baseline podcast. If they have not been, they've not known that you've already commented upon Serena Williams' stunning loss to Roberta Vinci. What were you thinking when that happened, Carl?
I was thinking, I guess I probably should write about this. And so are you, my
editor. I was bugging you in the corner of your ear. So was it the craziest upset of all time?
Well, you have to decide how you're going to define an upset. So if Serena lost to the number 500 player in the world in some tournament most people haven't heard of, we weren't going to count that. So we first just looked at Grand Slams. Then we said, well, first round losses are really surprising and often to really low-ranked players, but that can often mean that the player who is upset came in injured or just not prepared or not good on that surface. So we really were only looking at the later rounds of Slams. And based on that subset of matches, quarterfinals on at Grand Slam tournaments in the open era, so that's a few qualifiers for you, but still we're talking about modern women's tennis. This was the biggest upset of all time. And that's based on looking at the ELO ratings that we talked about in the show a couple weeks ago to rate Serena Williams relative to the greatest of all time. So looking at her ELO rating and Roberta Vinci's and the difference and comparing that to all other upsets late in slams, this was the big one.
It was interesting watching it and then immediately thinking, well, does Vinci have any chance in the final? Especially because in looking at the piece on 538, common sense will tell you it's probably difficult because then they're, if you're talking about Grand Slams, like you mentioned, they're facing another tough opponent. And also there's however way you quantify it, like the emotional high or impact of producing this win on such an epic scale. So what were you thinking, I guess, after the win about Vinci's chances in the final?
Well, there was a lot going on that could go either way, I think. Because on the one hand, like you say, she was going to play someone else who was higher ranked. In a Grand Slam final, you tend to play a really good player. On the other hand, the first semifinal of the day, while nowhere near as high profile as Serena's loss, was the number two player in the world also losing to a player outside the top 20. So Vinci was going to play Flavia Pennetta, who was ranked higher than her, but not by that much. And Pennetta was almost as big a surprise to be in the final as Vinci. Less of a surprise because she didn't have to beat Serena to do it. So I think Vinci definitely had a chance, and actually that first set was a great set and could have gone either way. But I think the emotional letdown factor is definitely one. She also had a tougher match later in the day, and they had to play on consecutive days because the roof is still not done on our Thrash Stadium, so the women's semis were delayed by a day. But you might also think, well, if you just upset a great player, you must be playing really good tennis. Maybe your ranking is unfair to you. Maybe you've been injured for a while, and you're just now getting back to your previous form. So I'm a little surprised at how unlikely it's been for players who have pulled off these upsets to follow them up with another one.
And so what's next for Serena? So we saw her win 3 out of 4 Grand Slams, come within 2 matches of completing the calendar year Grand Slam. You've written a lot about Serena Williams' career trajectory and whether or not she's the greatest of all time or just a great. It seems to me like the field continues to be pretty weak around her. And so should we think that there's any reason why she'll slow down just because of this one loss?
Yeah, I certainly don't think this one loss changes much of what we think about her, because we saw all year that she was getting into these tough scraps against players much lower ranked than her. This one turned out to just barely be a loss, but we're talking about the difference of a few points. So I don't think it's a major indicator of anything different than what we thought heading into that match. Right after she'd beaten Venus Williams, her sister, in a pretty tough match, she'd had a tough match earlier in the tournament, probably should have lost at Wimbledon to Heather Watson. So I think what this just reminds us is it was pretty extraordinary what she had just done, especially because she had to win so many tough matches. I also think it doesn't lessen her legacy at all that she lost the match relative to what it was coming into the U.S. Open. but she didn't get the calendar year Grand Slam. And insofar as it matters that it's four in a row versus four in 1 year, that's probably going to be her last chance to do it because it's just so hard to keep winning those tight matches.
So what's her – I like to think about the ELO rating concept because it's something where we had talked when you came in before the U.S. Open about how Serena was actually having trouble adding to her rating relative to some of these other all-time greats because she was favored very heavily to win every single match. So even when she won, it was like, ho-hum, she didn't really pick up that many points. How many did she lose by losing this particular match, and did she – what did that compare to her rating, for instance, going into the tournament or like – in one match, did she lose, like, you know, X number of wins worth of ELO points or something?
So we haven't officially calculated yet, but we've done some back of the envelope, and it's worth a lot of wins, a lot of her typical wins. I think if she were beating the number two player in the world, even then she would have to do it five or six times, let's say, to make up for a loss like that, because there is such a gap right now between her and even the very next best, and Vinci is not the very next best.
All right, let's move on to the men's side, and where Novak Djokovic beat Roger Federer in a great match on Sunday night. Here's our hot take coming from Djokovic himself in a press conference with reporters.
You know, I think it's logical to expect that somebody, a great player and a champion like Roger, has the majority of the support anywhere I play him. I accept the fact, you know, everybody has a choice to support a player that they want to support.
Carl, it does seem to me like people love Roger Federer much more than they love Novak Djokovic. Should they, from a stats perspective?
Well, first of all, I don't think we should ever hold fans to the standard that they have to support a player if he's statistically better. I think there are many reasons that they support Federer over Djokovic, many of them that we could challenge, but I think everyone has the right to decide who they support. But statistically, Djokovic is playing, at least according to the ELO rating we also talked about for Serena Williams, he's playing at a level that no one really has reached in men's tennis. It's very close, and for instance, Bjorn Borg was close, and it also depends how you define it, so there's a lot of caveats, including maybe you don't like ELO ratings and would prefer to just count Grand Slam titles. But I think just the eye test, and former pros will confirm this, Djokovic is doing things overall in his game, in his tactics, in his fitness that probably no one has ever done quite as well. So I think if we do want to say you should support a player who's the best player, then Djokovic definitely should have more support. I also think from a non-statistical point of view, he should be getting a lot more support. But it's also this strange nature of tennis fandom that fans tend to appreciate players once they've gotten more familiar with them and they're later in their career. But that's also when they're declining and less likely to win. So you might feel like you're always having heartbreak when you're following tennis because you're really getting into a player right when they're less likely to win.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You have a graph up in your article with Ben Morris about the men's ELO ratings that Federer sort of reached that level in, what, like 2007 or so, and then has been kind of declining and has made this late career renaissance. And Djokovic has surpassed that level very recently. But then there's, like, between Federer and maybe, like, Borg or McEnroe, there's almost like this trough during the 90s, which we think of as being this great era of tennis with Sampras and Agassi. Neither of their ratings are really all that high. So do you think maybe at least from a non-American or maybe an international standpoint, like Federer is this player that sort of emerged, you know, as a true all-time great after this period of, you know, players that didn't necessarily have the staying power, and maybe that accounts for his popularity now. And maybe Djokovic, like you said, will get that. We'll finally appreciate him when he starts to decline and someone else comes along.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I think people in the U.S. certainly appreciate Sampras and Agassi, but maybe, whether consciously or not, the international fan base was perceiving that not only was Federer winning at a rate that would allow him to challenge Sampras for the most Grand Slams of all time, but also that he was actually playing at a higher level. Now, a lot of people, including David Foster Wallace, appreciated his level from an aesthetic point of view, but maybe he was also just playing better tennis from an absolute point of view, and that made it a more attractive, interesting, compelling game.
So Federer, though, is still playing better than anyone his age has ever played before, and that gap is pretty significant. So we keep waiting for Federer's decline to come, and I've been thinking a lot about whether or not that's fair, because we're looking at average age curves, basically. But Federer has always been so much better than the field that perhaps he's going to defy the field in age as well, and that shouldn't be surprising because he's playing at such a high level now.
Yeah, and Andy Murray was asked about this at Wimbledon after Murray came into a semifinal against Federer playing great tennis, and Federer beat him quite handily playing incredible tennis. And he said it then, and he said it other times, why would you expect Federer to follow anyone else's template for their career? Which also means it's really too early to assess them. So it's fun to write the story that Ben and I did assessing them now. But Federer clearly has more in him, and who knows how much more, and he could have an injury, and you're probably more prone to it at 34. But also Djokovic is 28, so we really can't assess him yet. But because everyone's already doing it anyway, we wanted to add our take based on Elo.
So one last question as we bring the tennis season to a close. As I watched tennis, as I watched the U.S. Open, this tournament, it really seemed to me as though tennis is the thing that has is the sport that has the most psychology baked into the sport, where we really where the stats really can't tell us about strength, because Serena Williams, let's say, can psych herself out and start hitting four, and her forehand can disappear on her. Federer's forehand seemed to disappear on him during parts of his finals match. Whereas in football, in team sports especially, the quality of the team, baseball aside, tends to win out. Is that the case from you watching it really closely as a stats person and as a big tennis fan, that the psychology of tennis almost supersedes the stats of it?
It's a really tough question. I think about it a lot when I watch. I think there is a lot of psychology, but I think also what we perceive as a tight forehand could be a tactical decision that if I hit my normal forehand against Novak Djokovic, it's not going to work nearly as well as it did against Richard Gasquet. So I need to go for a tougher shot. And so if you're watching casually, you'll say, boy, he really missed an easy shot. But he might say, well, there's a 20% chance I miss it if I hit it this way, but there's a 30% chance I will eventually lose the point if I hit it more safely. But we also can see their faces, and we can't when players are wearing helmets in other sports, and they're alone on the court, and there's so many camera angles up close. And we can see they are showing a lot of emotion and reacting very clearly. But then again, you can see their emotions and not know what they're thinking. Ever watch Andy Murray match, you'll have no idea if he's happy or sad based on his face.
And I think you could also make a case that tennis is the most statistical of the sports in the sense that there's the least randomness. And if randomness is the enemy of us forecasting types, tennis really gives you huge sample sizes. And it's there's not, you know, any of the interference that you get in football from teammates or even in basketball like there is in an individual sport like tennis.
But there is the point, I mean, that you said that we have the statistical analysis, the numbers to look at, but we still just don't know the psychology of why certain shots were, they took certain shots. And the behind that and like the value they're placing on going for a kill shot versus playing a point out.
And we often will never find out, because when you'll ask players after matches, some of them will remember every point in great, almost photographic detail, but a lot of them will have trouble telling you even what the score was in the most recent set of the match, let alone why they hit a certain shot when they hit it. And with such high speed of shot and such quick decision making, it'll be hard for them to even access their own thoughts and feelings at any moment. So it makes for a lot of fun speculation for me as well when I watch matches, but it's a really tough question to answer.
All right, Carl, thanks for coming in yet again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk tennis.
And listeners, you can read all of Carl's coverage of tennis and all these ELO ratings that we keep talking about at 538.com. All right, let's move on to baseball. We are talking about the Mets, but there's a reason, and I think it's actually about more than just the Mets. It's about what
or
it means.
Once.
It's a big picture discussion.
It's about what it means to be an MVP. It's about whether leagues still matter in baseball or in any league. We're talking about Yoenis Cespedes, of course. He's been on a tear with the Mets since coming to the Mets in the trade deadline. At the end of July, he's given the Mets 2.3 WAR, quite a bit, given that he's only played 41 games for them. He's had almost as many RBI as the number of, sorry, more RBI, 42, the number of games that he's played, 41. He's batting 309, 1,048 OPS, yada, yada. He's really good. Here, and David Wright, the captain of the Mets, third baseman of the Mets, because he's been so good, says that Cespedes should be, quote, in the discussion for NL MVP, despite only spending 40 days there. And because Wright said that, lots of wags got their tongues wagging. Here is Ben Walker, AP baseball writer.
The guy is so popular. I mean, all the phrases you hear, the summer of Cespedes and Cespedes for the rest of us. Now, that said, he's going to play 2 months. He's going to play one-third of his season. is it fair that he could win the MVP? Personally, I don't think so. I mean, other players have been around. You know, obviously Bryce Harper, Anthony Rizzo, a lot of players in the National League have been contributing.
So we've talked about MVP discussions a lot on the show. I don't think we've done it for baseball yet. Mm-hmm. Where do you guys come down on this? How much should stats dominate, and should leagues carry any weight as well?
That's the interesting part to me, is the league discussion. Because is Cespedes or anyone who is traded midseason just supposed to live in quarantine over here and not be eligible for the MVP award in either league?
And let the general manager take that chance away from him by trading him, right? That it's not even
right.
up to him.
So, I mean, obviously nobody's talking about him being the AL MVP because of the impact he's made on the Mets. So I just don't understand this idea that there's going to be a group of guys who have been, whoever they are, who have been traded from AL to NL or vice versa, that now they are just not eligible, because we see it as this award that designates impact within a within the National League, as if he was not playing in Major League Baseball before he came into the National League. That's what's confusing to me, is that, yes, he's only been in the NL for a certain amount of time, but he's had a great season actually overall in Major League Baseball, and he can't just exist in this netherland where we act like he hasn't played in Major League Baseball all year.
Yeah, I mean, I can see both sides, because it is a totally arbitrary designation as to whether you're in the AL or the NL. And like you said, the GMs actually have control over that more than you do. And also that, you know, if you look at his stats for the whole year, he's been the fifth best player in baseball. Of course, he hasn't been at the same level as Bryce Harper in terms of WAR, and Bryce Harper is in the National League. But I think there's also an argument to be made that you know, you should be credited for things even if you're in the National League for 41 games, like Cespedes. If those games are really important toward potentially winning the National League, or in this case, winning the division, and certainly Cespedes has had a lot of huge hits at very crucial times in the Mets season, that should carry weight. So I kind of go back and forth on it, because, you know, there was an argument between the famous sabermetric argument between Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera several times over the past few years, and that argument seemed to come down to, do you take someone who has had an amazing individual season and don't really think about the things of, like, the context of when they had their best games, or did they make the playoffs? And there was the thing where Trout's team had more wins but didn't make the playoffs, whereas Cabrera's team had fewer but did, and so does that count for or against Trout? In this case, you know, you have Harper, who is actually having one of the all-time great seasons. We talked about Trout. Harper is right in that discussion with the seasons that Trout had a couple years ago that were lauded as some of the best ever. And his numbers on a rate basis, especially his hitting numbers.
What do you mean by rate basis?
So on, like, a per plate appearance basis, and he's played 136 games in the National League, and Cespedes has only played 41, that even though he's had the larger sample, which would be tougher to maintain such a high rate in, his rates are better over the whole season than Cespedes's are inside of this little window in which Cespedes has played in the National League and taken it by storm. So I think there's a lot of different arguments to be had here, and I would love to see a stat, and I don't think it exists, where you actually look at, like, pennant probability added, where you take the concept of win probability added within a game where you say,
you just assigned yourself a new piece.
That's right.
That sounds like a good. Let's talk about this next week then, after he figures it out.
Maybe not next week, but where you take the events that really are important to winning a game, and use the what's called leverage index to kind of measure that within a game. Why not apply that to the entire season, so that, for instance, games in which you have less knowledge of how the season's going to play out, and therefore they don't appear to be as important, like in April and even in May, aren't given as much weight as games where you know that you have to win these games in order to continue or add to your playoff chances. I think that in a stat like that, whereas, you know, at Fangraphs, unweighting by the importance of the games, Harper is miles ahead. He's number one in the National League, and Cespedes is 30th in wins above replacement. I think if you started weighing things by how important the games were to your odds of making the playoffs or winning the division or what have you, that Cespedes would clearly shoot up the standings, and maybe he has a case, and we just don't know it because that stat doesn't exist.
Right, because most of the people voting for these things are not paying attention to what every player is doing every single game. A lot of times you just have to catch up on what they've done over the course of a couple of weeks where you haven't seen them play. And this happens in all sports where, you know, you collect a lot of stats in what's the equivalent of, like, garbage time. And I'm not saying Harper, that's the reason specifically for the great season he's had, but you have to at least weigh the importance of the games and the importance of the moments in which he is accumulating all of these stats. Because if you're not paying attention every single game, and there's a lot of Nets fans who are to Bryce Harper, then you don't really know in what moments things are actually have as much weight. And you could say with Cespedes that a lot of what he's done has had a lot of weight for the
Nets.
Well,
Harper has had the chance to have a lot of weight, and he's played well. It's just his team has been really bad
around
him.
And
that's
kind of
Harper's fault.
The conversation is like, if they're not going to make the playoffs, then you go back to the larger conversation of how can he be the MVP?
Yeah, and this idea of like playoff leverage in addition to game level leverage does in many ways unfairly penalize you for having bad teammates, because Harper in September has been knocking the cover off of the baseball, and yet the Nationals are floundering and look like they're not going to make the playoffs. So it's a case where you have to decide how much context you want to include and how much you want to kind of isolate. We talked about this when we were talking about the NBA. Do you want the MVP to equal the best player? Do you want it to equal the most valuable player in the sense if he added the most to your chances of making the playoffs? We have to kind of decide what that means, and unfortunately the award itself doesn't come with an instruction manual that tells you ahead of time what to value.
So one more thing on this, it's a meta point. What I found really fascinating about this whole Cespedes for MVP storyline is it worked out almost like political news did. There was a trial balloon that was floated, like, should Cespedes be MVP? David Wright says, I think he's in the discussion, and then the discussion begins around it. And it's the way that sports media works now is that these little blips come out, and whatever catches fire is what ends up really, the fire really spreads. And like, this is the new sports media where small stories can sort of float out there, and then they're glommed onto or they aren't. That's a lot of mixed metaphors.
Well, especially when the larger conversation is like something we would look to in the future is like, can guys switch leagues and win the MVP? Right. Like, that's something we actually should have a discussion about.
All right, so let's leave it there for Cespedes. I look forward to him hoisting the trophy, the World Series trophy. Not the MVP trophy. I don't think he deserves it, but that's neither here nor there. All right, let's move on from baseball to our weekly significant digit segment. As always, Allison McCann is here. Hi, Allison.
Hey, John.
And Allison, this is the part of the show where you bring us some telling number from the world of sports. What do you have for us this week?
I have 4 as this week's significant digit, which is the change in ranking from, I guess I'm going to call it the pre-World Cup break to the end of the NWSL season. And 4 is the change in ranking that Kansas City moved from down at their lowest in 7th place. At this pre-World Cup break to finishing the season in 3rd. This was interesting to me because Kansas City and Seattle are playing in the championships next week again, the same 2 teams. And Seattle sort of has had this 2 seasons in a row, this like perfect, like basically, you know, struggling around from 1st to 2nd to 3rd and then finishing the season. And Kansas City had this very clear like first half of the season struggle, World Cup tanking period, and then steady rise after. So I thought that 4 was indicative of them moving
so this
up.
This is the Women's Soccer League in the States. And so was Kansas City one of the worst teams in the league during the World Cup and then rebounded to be one of the best?
Yeah, they moved to 7th during that World Cup period, whereas Seattle stayed up in 2nd place.
Was it connected? Did they have a lot of players playing in the World Cup, or is that was it a coincidence?
They did. They had, I think, about 4 missing, too, but it was pretty even throughout the league. I wouldn't say that, but Seattle definitely did, of anyone, had the fewest missing and also, you know, had a goalkeeper missing and maybe less, like, integral players. So there was something to say for that, but.
Yeah, there's also even more stats around the league, just, like, I think it was something like the number of fans they needed in the last, like, week of play to reach 5,000 average per game. And it wasn't like outlandish, you know, it was like they each team needed, you know, to average a certain amount. And 5,000, considering where they were before the World Cup, was really significant. Like, not just the bump we're talking here with Kansas City, which is definitely a hotbed for soccer. And you would think that not just their team, but the kind of program they could build in the NWSL could be really positive for that league. Just seems like all of the bump around the World Cup, and specifically the fan base, has this league in an ability where you can look and project now into the future. You could say, like, all right, I can see this league being around 5 or 6 years. And as you know, no soccer league has made it past, what, the 3-year mark.
Yeah, I'm excited for this final because I think these 2 teams are so different. And, like, there's something to say for the Seattle model, which is a win percentage of 500 through the World Cup, their win percentage post World Cup is even better. I think it's like 80%. And then Kansas City is taking this more gradual approach. So, like, which will prove to be most beneficial?
And they're the same two teams, which is really interesting. Like, we talked about the chaos of the EPL that wasn't really all that chaotic. So it might just be something in soccer, right? Like, these two teams were the best last year, and they're going to end up being the two best this year. And they may have, you know, wound a circuitous path to that. But maybe that's just how soccer is.
So that final is on October 1st, so we have a little while so people can catch up on highlights and get to know the two teams. Allison, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Thank you, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Jody Abergan, whose show, What's the Point?, continues to burn up the iTunes charts. Subscribe if you want to hear about how data is affecting our lives. We got production assistance from Jordan Shulkin. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps, iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. Review, rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.